12:12 on the Noon Business Lunch. Jason Turner joins us now, Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. End of year, a lot of numbers, a lot of reports, a lot of stories, right, Jason?
Absolutely, John. Lots of new data out this week, lots of things going on in the market.
What jumps out at you? What do you think is most critical for us to pay attention to?
Well, from a market perspective, the most thing to, important thing to pay attention to is the market's seeming reversal of the pessimism around the AI trade that's existed for the last few weeks, at least this week. And we're right now sitting at about flat for the week. We've seen a bit of a turnaround in names like Oracle that had suffered through some of these AI-related pullbacks. That's encouraging that the market is showing some signs of positive life as we run into next week, which could be your Santa Claus rally week as well.
Steve alluded to that a little while ago, the Santa Claus rally. And I thought, well, that would be nice, but shoot, even if we didn't have a Santa Claus rally, the whole year has been a Santa Claus rally.
Oh, absolutely. And it really, we could string together the last 3 years of really outsized returns in equity markets. Still a little bit off our highs this year, particularly within the technology sector. I think we could make a push to retrace towards those highs as we run into the end of the year with that rally, but you're absolutely right. Anybody who's stayed invested over the course of a turbulent year this year has been well rewarded as we look back on a year-to-date basis.
Like, guys, don't get greedy here. But should people stay invested? I mean, this isn't going to last forever. What do you think about that, Jason?
No, it's not going to last forever. I think there's been a lot of talk and a lot of the weakness we saw in some stocks and some sectors was related to higher valuations. Those still exist. We still sit at very stretched levels of valuation. We are skeptical that we can keep up this pace of growth in markets going forward, but that is not an endorsement to say you need to pull money out and sit on the sidelines. We're strong proponents that it is time in the market and not timing the market that matters. And while stretched valuations mean you may be more likely to experience some loss in a short-term window, we're still seeing strong company financials backing these and increasing earnings, and that's an environment where stocks can continue to march higher.
So much talk this year has been about the Fed and interest rates. Some of that was political, but some of it was a legitimate, interesting monetary conversation. So how would you assess how the Fed has performed this year? And what do you expect from them in the turn of the new year?
I think the Fed has done an adequate job this year. They were right to pull back and wait and see how things were going to play out over the course of the year. If we rewind to the beginning of the year, we were all worried that inflation was going to rapidly accelerate because of tariffs, and that hasn't quite materialized. Although we are seeing higher levels of inflation than what the Fed targets. So the Fed is still stepping carefully. They've tried to be a little preemptive to weakness in the labor market by making a few cuts here in the fall. That seems to have been appropriate up until maybe December's, and then it seems we've got a lot of division amongst the Fed's 12 or the FOMC's 12 voting members on whether that was the right policy decision this month and what they're going to do next year. The market's really anticipating just one cut next year, that the Fed is kind of done for the time being, and we'll sit and watch and wait to see more inflation and employment data.
Does that come in January?
Yes, we should start to resume a normal pace of both employment data report and inflation reports. The flurry of data we got this week is somewhat underwhelming because we didn't collect anything in October. We only collected some things in November, so they used a predictive formula as opposed to actual observed data to comment on inflation. So I don't put a lot of stock in the numbers we just saw come out this week. I'm going to wait till next month, and that'll give me a better sense for where inflation really has gone, how employment markets really are holding up.
Right, right, right. Yeah, we talked about that at some length yesterday, that we're missing about 6 or 7 weeks of data. But if, in fact, it is trending down, and then after the first of the year we find out that that's a real trend, then maybe we shave another quarter point, right?
Well, I'm not so sure of that. I think if the Fed sees in the January releases that we do have a slight weakening trend in inflation and employment markets are holding up or maybe starting to weaken a little bit more, maybe on the margin some of them would be interested in a further cut. I think the vast majority of the Fed wants to pull back for a few meetings and wait and see. Personally, I wouldn't be expecting the Fed to make any meaningful policy change until at least the spring, more likely when we get to the June window.
Okay, fair enough. And then one last thing. So your advice to clients right now is stand pat. Is that right?
Absolutely. Stay invested. Take advantage of market disruptions and dislocations to rebalance your portfolio. End of year is a great time to do that because you've got a lot more visibility on taxes, and you can make some tax positive trades in your portfolio as well. Take some of those losses, help it offset some of those gains, and reallocate to things that you're positive on for 2026.
And are you rotating your clients a little bit anyway out of AI or out of high tech?
We will be doing a rebalance coming up here at the end of the year as we normally do. That'll be adjusting for some of the outsized gains we saw in equities, along with some of the opportunities we see in places like infrastructure on a go-forward basis for our clients.
Yeah. It's always good to talk to you, Jason. Nice to hear your voice. Jason Turner, Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. Thanks, Jason. Tim Parody joins us again, the Future of Work and Trending correspondent at BusinessInsider.com. He's got a piece now about the boss watching you while you work. Welcome to the golden age of employee monitoring. Really the golden age, Tim? You make that sound like it's a good thing.
Well, I don't write the headlines, but we want to.
You don't write the headlines, but we want to what? Now he just cut out. Hold on. We'll get him back on here. Tim, are you there? Come on, Tim. Come around. There he is. Hey, Tim, are you still there?
I'm here. Yeah. Sorry about
that. Okay. No, it's no problem. So talk a little bit about your reporting on this.
Well, essentially, it's just the technology has gotten better to where companies can, can monitor what their workers are doing more easily in a range of fields.
And is this people working at home or is it in an office setting? Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. It really runs the gamut. So if you're working on site in, say a distribution center or something like that, there's a ton of monitoring that goes on there. If you're working remotely at a desk job, companies can track keystrokes. They can see how much time you're spending in certain applications. There's a whole range of things they can do.
And I guess that's in the interest of keeping the business running smoothly. I mean, I don't want to say justify it, but tell me the value of it or why they do that.
Well, in some cases, it has a lot to do with data loss prevention. So they're just worried about, key information slipping outside the company. So that's one aspect of it. A lot of the monitoring is, to be fair, sort of passive. They might just look for things like file transfers that are large or, sort of red flag things like that, whereas they're not necessarily doing things like monitoring every keystroke or how much time. It's just that they have that ability.
So are we talking about efficiency or are we talking about cybersecurity or safety or theft, that sort of thing?
It really depends on the employer, but this is certainly something that came up more during the pandemic when more desk workers were remote, so that there was a little bit of a sense from some of the folks I spoke to that, gosh, we don't know what our people are doing and are they still on task? But in many cases, it might just be something a little bit more around. We just wanted to make sure that we have proper security in place. So again, it really ranges depending on the employer.
And you said this was more maybe necessary during the pandemic. Has that trend continued? Can you quantify it, percentages or hours or anything like that?
Well, some of the technology companies that provide, thinking Google, Microsoft, these big companies that provide a lot of workplace technology have made it easier for employers to monitor if the employer chooses to do that. So they've made it, for example, so if you're on a work phone or something like that, they can catalog text messages, things like that, more easily with some coming updates than what they could do in the past. And that's kind of a recognition that people work in ways and more than just, say, work email or something like that. But again, that's often on a work device, though there are things they can do on a personal device as well if you have, for example, your Slack or your work email on a personal device.
The monitoring your keystrokes is a little big brotherish to me. That's a little, I don't know, if that crosses the line, doesn't that sound a little threatening to you?
It does to me, of course, but I think, and sometimes this happens more in something, thinking like a call center or something like that versus another, maybe a different kind of desk job where they're not going to get to that level of monitoring because they don't necessarily want to hurt morale to that degree, or they don't necessarily want the headache of doing that, and they'll really only jump in when they feel like there's maybe some issue that they need to take a closer look at.
According to the U.S. Government Accountability Office, you wrote, workers tend to be in favor of monitoring if it's intended to protect their safety. I was thinking about that. And often are opposed if it's intended to track productivity. Don't they know that's why we're trying to work at home? We don't want you monitoring the fact that we are vacuuming right now, or watching TV, or we're actually at the store right now, but we still get the job done. So why do you have to track us so closely? I suppose it's in response to some of that, huh?
Sure. There are always going to be outlier cases where, you know, CEOs have their noses bent over the fact that somebody is either working a double job or is not doing what they're supposed to be doing when they're supposed to be doing it. But to your point, you know, a lot of other people would say, even bosses would say, if the work's getting done — I talk to CEOs all the time — you know, if the work's getting done, I'm not really worried about it.
Really? Well, what is the story? I know you mentioned this, personal devices versus company devices. How much control or access do they have, or should they have, over my own laptop, my own phone, et cetera?
Well, that's the kind of stuff that on your first day of a job, when you're signing all that paperwork, it might be something you want to pay attention to. That's oftentimes when that kind of thing is disclosed. And so they might say that, you know, if we're going to put this little app on your phone that's going to allow you to sign into your, you know, various work apps or other things like email. So pay attention to that. Some of the legal experts I spoke to said, you know, ask questions if you're not sure. It's reasonable to just to find out. You know, and I think it's probably common sense for most of your listeners that if, you know, you're on a work device, whether it's a laptop or a phone, just assume that anything on there is fair game, which it is, because it's their equipment. I think where it gets stickier, to your point, is when it's my personal phone, but I'm using work email. Luckily, the technology has gotten a little bit better so that they can, if you were to leave the company, as an example, the employer could go in and zap just maybe that work email without having to wipe the phone, whereas years ago it was more of a, it was less of a surgical strike, and they might have had to just clear everything out.
That's interesting. Welcome to the golden age of employee monitoring. And yeah, you didn't write the headline, but I get the point that it's ever expanding. It's more opportune if invasive, but there's pros and cons to it in Business Insider, Tim Paradis' story. Okay, Tim, always nice to talk to you. Thanks for your help today.
Likewise. Thanks, John.
12:34, noon business lunch on WGN. John Williams here. Neil Fisher's our producer today. And Richard Demergen makes a return visit to the show. Actually, Richard, I don't know if I've talked to you before, but I know I've talked to some of your colleagues. You were the president at TCCI Manufacturing, a business that we've been sort of charting in Decatur. Welcome back to the show. Or help me out, Richard. Is this your first time visit with us?
Yeah, John, thanks for having me on. I believe it is my first time. My sister Kara has been on. Kara Demergen Huss has been on with you in the past.
Yeah. And she's terrific, too, by the way.
Thanks, yes. I get introduced as Kara's brother everywhere I go.
Well, so is this a family business then?
It is, right. TCCI Manufacturing, we're located here in Decatur, Illinois. Our father went out on his own in 1984 and kind of worked for BorgWarner, and at age 52 bought the business, started with carburation in Ireland, and then in 87 bought the York compressor line from BorgWarner. And so, yeah, I'm running the air conditioning side of the business.
So compressors, air conditioners, just what's your catalog? Just tell me what you guys make there in Decatur.
Yeah, we manufacture air conditioning compressors for commercial vehicles. We also develop the whole thermal solution, so all the help the customers deal with the whole AC and heating system and how it operates, and our facilities can test all that. But we're located here in Decatur, with facilities all over the world.
And then do I find your products in, like, refrigerated trucks hauling meat and produce up and down the road? Where do your products land?
Yeah, anybody that earns a living with their vehicle, right? So Thermo King Carrier for your refrigerated trucks, International trucks cooling the cabs, Caterpillar tractors, John Deere, Case New Holland, agricultural equipment, all the military type products, that the Oshkosh, the Joint Strike Vehicles that are out there, and were in Iraq and Afghanistan all use our compressors.
Isn't it amazing how many different companies have to come together to make something, be it a military vehicle or a truck on I-80? What is your connection to the EV market?
All right, so as the commercial vehicles have taken their journey to EVs, we make both the ICE engines, the belt internal combustion engine vehicles that are belt driven, and then we also manufacture the electric compressors for either cooling the cab or the ones that are doing the entire battery coolant management system.
That's in an EV per se, right?
Correct, yes. So the batteries have to be kept at a very constant temperature in an EV, around 25 degrees Celsius, and they need a cooling system in order to do that.
I never thought about that, but batteries do get hot. What's 25 degrees Celsius in Fahrenheit?
It's about 75 to 80 degrees.
Okay, so as it's running or on a hot day, you need an air. I never thought about this. We need to cool that battery. There you guys are. How's business? Because the EV market is, if not softening, it's not growing the way it was. And this isn't an administration that's embracing that. The tax credit's gone. How's business for you guys in that sector?
Well, you know, I think you've got, for us, we deal globally out there. So every sector is different, like construction and ag really weren't really moving hard down the EV. The over-the-road trucking was. A lot of the North American over-the-road trucking guys have moved their strategy with this administration away from EV, but they're still now looking at hybrids because there are still new CAFE requirements that are going to be coming out in 2027 for some of the engine stuff. And they do need to continue to make those combustion engines more efficient. So the air conditioning compressor, which is driven off the engine, they're looking at taking that off and having that as a, let's say, a low voltage compressor that will improve gas mileage and allow those engines to stop longer at stoplights, just like what the automotive guys have done.
Hmm. Well, do you have your finger on the pulse around the world on the EV market, either commercially or for people like you and me just driving our own cars? I'm under the impression that Europe and Asia are full speed ahead on that, and we're dragging our heels. Is that your experience? Do you have access to that kind of information or market?
Yeah, absolutely do. So we supply globally into Europe, Volkswagen truck and bus globally out there, as well as into China and South America and India. And every market is a little bit different. Take India, for instance. India is really pushing hard towards mass transit electrification. So they're still, Modi is still full steam ahead with electrification of buses and other large mass transit operations. Europe still is marching for commercial vehicles under the Paris Accord, which is trying to push to 30% commercial vehicle over the road electrification by 2030. We think that's going to push out. The charging infrastructure just isn't there to establish that, and the vehicles are still a little too expensive. So we think that's going to soften, but it's still a goal for them and a requirement to register a certain percentage of their vehicles under those Paris Accords.
Well, you guys have you opened or are you going to open some sort of climate center? Seems to me like your sister spoke to us about that before.
Yeah. So here in Decatur, Illinois, I'm sure Kara talked about our public-private. We did receive some grant money from the University of Illinois, for the state of Illinois, sorry, and as well as some federal money. And we are putting in a major climate center that will allow us to go from the component level testing to the system to the whole vehicle. That should be all completed by sometime around March or April, and, you know, we'll be able to test a full-size bus or truck running at 100 miles an hour from minus 40 to 130 F with solar, basically have almost any condition on earth right here in Decatur, Illinois.
Wow. How's business, by the way?
Business is steady. Again, market to market, product to product varies. But here in the U.S., things are, you know, we never hit that big recession people were talking about. So things are still fairly steady. I would say pretty flat from last year to this year, which I think is positive.
Yeah, well, that's not negative. Richard Demergent is the president of TCCI Manufacturing. TCCIMFG.com is their website. Richard, my best to your employees, your family, and thanks for giving us some of your time today.
Okay, thanks, John. Pleasure.
Always nice to catch up with those folks. By the way, after the news at the top of the hour here, or just around the corner from that, we'll do our monthly. We haven't been doing this every month. We missed a couple of months when Sarah Thiemann, who was long our marketing manager, our sort of the person that helped coordinate a lot of our events, she moved to England. And she's still reading. And they happen to speak English over there. And so she's going to join us, as she has in the past. Steve and Bob and I will chime in on the books that we have been reading. I will just give you a couple of headlines from the books that I'm going to be talking about. I'm not sure what's on their list. But one of them is Fancy Bear Goes Fishing, The Dark History of the Information Age in 5 Extraordinary Hacks. It's by Scott Shapiro, and it's a really well-written book, even though it was written in 2023. And that's a long time in terms of the internet and cybersecurity and hacks. That whole world is changing so rapidly. But this book is still very, very interesting. And it takes a deep dive into the release of Paris Hilton's sex tape from her phone. And it's very interesting how that happened, how that still happens, what we do and don't do to protect ourselves, and really how an operating system and a computer works, how your phone works. And while that all sounds very technical and wonky, I found the book really interesting. You're sort of able to understand it and the result where the vulnerabilities are, where the opportunities are. And so the Paris Hilton case is one of the 5 cases that he talks about. It's a very interesting book that you may have missed if that's an area of interest to you. It is to me. Fancy Bear Goes Fishing. Fishing spelled with a PH, don't you know? The Dark History of the Information Age and 5 Extraordinary Hacks. He tells you about those hacks and then how they happened. Speaking of the whole internet and crypto world, or the tech world, crypto managed to make it through the year without a systemic collapse or a major scandal, yet it's still shaping up to be one of the industry's worst years ever. This from CNN today. Until October, Bitcoin had been riding high, hitting a peak of $126,000. That was up 30% since January. But a combination of forces has wiped out all of the bellwether. My screen just stopped working. Okay, now it's come back, which I kind of need to read this story. But I wanted to share some of these numbers with you because some of you know all too well what's happened to your crypto stocks. Until October, Bitcoin has been riding high, hitting a peak of $126,000, up more than 30% since January. But a combination of forces has wiped out all of the bellwether tokens' gains for the year. It's now down 7% since January, badly underperforming the S&P 500 stock index, which itself is up 15% for the year. We were talking about a possible Santa Claus rally earlier on the noon business lunch with Jason Turner, and I said, shoot, hasn't the whole year been a rally? And he said, yeah. There are no more boogeymen for the industry to blame. The Biden-era regulators that suppressed crypto's expansion in the U.S. are long gone, replaced by an openly pro-crypto regime appointed by the self-styled crypto president. Congress is advancing industry-approved legislation. Institutional adoption has surged, bringing in billions through Bitcoin exchange-traded funds. And still, the crypto can't seem to find its footing. After holding somewhat steady around $90,000 level in recent weeks, another steep sell-off sent Bitcoin tumbling to around 86,000. Remember, we had seen 126,000 this year. If Team Crypto is looking to point its finger for this bear market, it might consider a mirror. The story at CNN today says there are technical reasons for the slump, most notably an extreme buildup of leveraged positions, speculative bets, that can turbocharge gains but come with extreme downside risks that were liquidated in an early October flash crash. But the protracted slump appears to be about more than just a hangover from that crash. Risk appetite has not gone away, as the tech-heavy NASDAQ has done even better than the broader stock market. So why are investors shunning this particular flavor of risk? One explanation is that crypto culture has refused to grow up, and it's keeping would-be investors on the sideline. Looking back on a year when crypto advocates got everything they could have dreamed of, from a legal and regulatory standpoint, the industry still hasn't figured out what to do with its problem children, the scammers, thieves, and internet trolls who haven't gotten the memo that crypto is trying to clean up its act. Over the summer, meme coin pushers claimed responsibility for an orchestrated effort to oh, that's funny. I remember this when it happened. I'll read this sentence. Over the summer, meme coin pushers claimed responsibility for an orchestrated effort to throw dildos onto the court during WNBA games, claiming it was an effort to make memes funny again. Now, the story goes on. It's CNN.com today. I remember when that happened, and I did not know what instigated that. Somehow it's all tied to this, and this is one of the reasons that people are maybe a little leery of the risk in that investment. My problem has long been, I don't know if that is a currency or if it's an investment. And if it's an investment, then it could go so wildly up and down. Why would you use it as currency? Why would you accept it as currency? Somebody started to explain that to me recently, and my eyes glazed over.